This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of a four-part mini-series of the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, where EFL department leads provide a unique insight into the workings of the organisation and explain some of the key roles and functions of the world's original league competition. What is it the Football League does? How do they do it? And why? Inside the walls of the EFL on this mini-series edition of the official EFL podcast. So on this particular episode, we're joined by Governance and Legal Director at the EFL, Nick Craig. We're going to talk regulatory matters. We're going to talk embargoes. And of course, Nick, where better to start than the owners and directors test? Do you want to just give us a little bit of an insight into what the process is of gaining EFL approval for the transfer of a football club as a starting point, please?
Well, firstly, thanks, Mark. The owners and directors test is a process whereby clubs have to submit individuals who want to acquire a controlling interest or take up a directorship at a club to us for prior approval. And that's an important point because it ensures that only those people who are eligible to act in accordance with that test get approved and then get appointed at the clubs.
And I mean, in terms of the sort of rule book you're applying, I mean, and this goes back to the podcast that we did with Trevor Birch, we did talk about the distinct characteristics of individual clubs, of owners, of values, of beliefs. It must be difficult to apply a one size fits all, isn't it, in those circumstances, because every story is going to be different?
Well, I think what the test does is it seeks to get over that hurdle by setting out really what is a quite a wide range of circumstances, which would mean that an individual is subject to a disqualifying condition. But equally, that means that as long as you aren't caught by those disqualifying conditions, you're absolutely eligible and welcome to become a director and or owner of an EFL club, subject to then also complying with other agreements and conditions that we might impose at the point of entry. But by that way, we do try and ensure that we're as flexible as possible, but whilst also strictly applying the conditions which we regard as disqualifying someone.
Nick, do you want to just outline for us what those disqualifying conditions would be, please?
There's quite a wide variety, actually, Mark, and they will stretch from at the top end having an unspent conviction for offences involving acts which we would reasonably consider to be dishonest or offences relating to corruption or perverting the course of justice as examples. And then it can also include ticket touting, or it can also stretch to then people who are maybe disqualified from acting as a director by other bodies, such as the High Court can issue a disqualification order against somebody who's been involved in the running of a company. It's been appropriate and then made the subject of an order to disqualify them from acting as a director of a company. So in those circumstances, for so long as they are disqualified, they would be subject to disqualifying condition. Similarly, people who might be subject to insolvency proceedings in relation to their own affairs, so bankruptcy or individual voluntary arrangements, for so long as those exist, they'd be subject to disqualifying condition. And then we've got sports-related ones as well. So if an individual is banned or suspended from involvement in sport by any sport governing body, and that's not just football, that's wider sports as well, then for the duration of that ban, they will be subject to a disqualifying condition. So those are some of the examples. There's a broad list, and those are all capable of being looked at. They're on the EFL website as we publish all of our regulations.
Aha. The other headline requirements, as well as no disqualifying conditions, would be what, Nick?
So first of all, provided somebody can demonstrate that they're not subject to disqualifying conditions, then what we're actually looking at is where they're becoming an owner of a club with an interest of, say, 30% or more is our usual benchmark. We're looking at them with a slightly different perspective. We're looking at them as future owners and therefore funders of the clubs. And we have to look then also at the source and the sufficiency of the funding that they are using, not only to acquire the interests in the club, but then also to fund the club going forwards. Now, all our clubs are required to have business plans on an ongoing basis. And we will be looking at those business plans at the point at which somebody is new, is coming to us and telling us that they want to be an owner of a football club, identifying what those cash requirements are going to be, and then looking to see if those individuals have got the actual funding that's necessary to support the club during that period. But importantly, what is the ultimate source of that funding? Because we need to ensure that we are tying together the source of the funds to the identity of the individuals that are presenting to us under the terms of the owners and directors test. There was the saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And that really is it. We've got to know that the people who are putting forward the cash are actually subscribing to the owners and directors test and disclosable on a transparent basis to the wider world.
Even after all your experience at the EFL, what, 20 years as the only in-house legal, and were you there a little bit before that as well? So
20 years and came in as the first in-house legal, but happily, more recently, I am supported by some other additional in-house legal resource. I've got a great team, and between us, we cover off a lot of legal and regulatory aspects on behalf of the league. But I'm not here on my own anymore. There's three of us in the legal area and other people with experience in governance as well.
For the reasons that I just said, which is every club has its own characteristic, every individual of the 7.8 billion in the world have their own ways of doing things, where they were brought up, things that they believe. This feels like it's swathed in complication. Would that be the reason that some tests take longer to come through than others? Or some owners take longer to be approved than others?
I think that's right. The process very much depends upon the club as well, because they understand the nature of the transaction that they're trying to conclude. And for some clubs, for example, they're well-resourced. They do a lot of work themselves into the background of the incoming purchaser and have collated a lot of information and like to come to us with a full package to say, we've done as much as we can, there it is, there is the transaction, and present us with as much information as they know that we might require, and then take a step back and say, please, can we have your approval? There are other circumstances where clubs come to us and say, we've got an interested buyer, we've not yet concluded the transaction, we want to understand what the league's requirements might be, because that's going to help us as part of our discussions with that buyer. And so we have a more working relationship with them through that process as well. So when you overlay that with every buyer is going to be an individual, their own background circumstances are going to be varied, as you say, based on where they're coming from, what their business background might be, how transparent is it in terms of where are they coming from. We live in a world where the transparency requirements vary from country to country. So absolutely, every case is going to be different. Every case presents its own challenges in terms of getting to a conclusion. Some are easier than others. Our object is always to try and get to a point whereby an incoming owner can comply with the requirements so that we can welcome them in and wish them well for the future. It's not always the case, but that remains our starting point.
One of the characteristics as well must be that occasionally there will be a club in dire need, which must compound the pressure on you guys if a club is, you know, in perilous danger and somebody wants to take them over, and there's that kind of situation there to be dealing with as well.
It can create quite a stressful situation, both for the club concerned and also for us here at the EFL, when those pressures exist. I mean, let's not get into today the need for the league and the clubs to look at the measures that help ensure that clubs are more sustainable, which can help remove that kind of pressure, because that's for another day entirely. But in circumstances where a club is in desperate need of incoming investment and everything like that, there is still an acceptance that the requirements of the rules still have to be followed. There can't be shortcuts, because if you start taking shortcuts, you're only likely to see problems further down the line. So it all does still have to be followed through. We do have to do all the checks and make sure that we are satisfied before we issue a final sign off. And we will work at the pace that the club requires wherever possible, but at the same time, you know, there may be more than one at any one time, and it's a question of balancing the roles that we've got in that context.
I kind of know what the answer to this one's going to be, but one of the criticisms, Nick, is communication about outcomes. outcomes on a sort of club by club basis. But I guess some of this information is quite privileged and needs to be kept in-house by both the clubs and the prospective owners.
So I think that's right. First and foremost, it's not actually for the league to publicise potential transactions. It really is a matter for the club and the counterparties to the transactions that they're doing as to what they want to put into the public domain. From our perspective, though, we are very clear. All clubs are required to publish the identity of the ultimate owners of interests of 10% or more in the club. They're also required to ensure that where there's changes in that, that's also reported to the league. And then, of course, post-completion, that obligation will apply to any new owners of the club in those circumstances. What the EFL can't do is, in that intervening period, provide a running commentary on what we are doing and how we're doing it. And there's a number of reasons for that. Firstly, as you rightly identified, Mark, the transaction is between the current owner and the prospective new owners, and they're the ones that should be commenting on it. Secondly, we don't necessarily want to reveal all the steps that we might take in respect of the research that we conduct in respect of individuals, because there are some elements of that that we don't necessarily want to publicise, because it's helpful in terms of getting to an outcome and a clear decision if we can manage that process internally to the EFL. And then finally, it'll be a massive distraction in terms of the work that we need to do, which is focusing on getting the regulations complied with by the incoming purchasers so that we can try and get it concluded as quickly as possible so they can actually get on with what it is that they want to do, which is owning and operating the clubs for the benefit of the wider community.
I mean, the league has been criticised for some of the ones that got in where things didn't quite work out as those owners had promised. But I'm guessing you reject quite a lot along the way, Nick.
First of all, I think it's just important to bear in mind that the owners and directors test ultimately is a test of eligibility. And that can't of itself regulate future conduct. So in terms of how an owner operates the club once they're in, again, that's possibly one for another day. There are a number of controls, but we can't control everything. The clubs are individual entities. The owners and the directors of those clubs have got their own responsibilities, and they must operate the club in accordance with those statutory duties imposed by company law and compliance with football association regulations and EFL regulations as well. But you're absolutely right. There are people that do not meet the requirements that the league impose on applications of this kind. Again, we don't publicise those because that is a private matter between us, the club, and the individuals concerned. But certainly, yes, there are those that didn't manage to make it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's an important point to make, isn't it? That the test, whatever people's perspective on it, Nick, is, it does reject people, but we wouldn't necessarily know who those are. Does it annoy you that it keeps getting referred to as the fit and proper person's test? How does that sit with you? Does that muddy the waters a little bit? Would you prefer every one of us described it as the owners and directors test?
Well, I think, first off, you said you've been there 20 years, Nick. Yeah, you have. And I came up with the first fit and proper person's test. So I gave it that title when we first wrote the rules. So okay. I've got to accept the blame for that context. But we did change it many, many years ago to better reflect what it is actually about. It is a test which applies to owners as well as directors. It isn't a fit and proper. It is an objective set of criteria that people have to meet in order to be eligible to take up a role of director or significant owner of a club. So, yeah, I think time's moved on. That is a better reflection. I don't like it harking back to fit and proper, to be honest with you. But as I say, I think I've probably got some bear some of the blame for that one.
Well, you do, except that hopefully what we've done here is given a little bit of an understanding as to how things work. We're at pains to stress we were never going to go into detail about individual clubs, but maybe we've just given a little bit of an insight into the process. Transfer embargoes, Nick, also fall under your remit. Do you want to give us a little overview as to, well, maybe explain the process of a club being placed under a registration embargo?
Yeah, I'm glad you made that correction then, because you started as a transfer embargo and have transitioned that to registration embargo. And I think that is an important...
Okay, tell me.
That is an important distinction, because transfer, that's what we all envisage. A player moves from club A to club B for a fee. It's announced and he signs his contract in front of all the cameras, and that's a transfer. What a registration embargo is it is a controlling measure that sits within the EFL regulations as a means of trying to get in front of potential problems. There are lots of reporting obligations on EFL clubs in our regulations, which are important to help ensure that the league has sight of the club's position in a number of different areas, particularly in the context of finances. So, for example, clubs are required to report whether they have paid the HMRC for the tax that's deducted in respect of staff wages. And if a club doesn't report, then that's a concern for us, and we will place it under a registration embargo until such time as the club has satisfied that requirement. Similarly, there are other requirements such as payments to other clubs, be that transfer fees, be that loan wages for all the players that move on loan throughout the pyramid, which help development opportunities for players. So where those payments aren't made on time, and we do track those, then that can also trigger a registration embargo. And that's from the perspective of, if they haven't paid their existing liabilities, they probably shouldn't be increasing their liabilities by taking on new players in those circumstances. So a registration embargo, to summarise, is a measure which is utilised to try and ensure that the clubs remain compliant with the various different obligations that there are under the regulations across a wide variety of areas, all focused on ensuring that they will be able to meet their liabilities going forwards, as well as balancing the interests of the competition as well. You can't have situations where some clubs choose not to comply with the regulations, but then can then sign new players and gain a competitive advantage over those clubs that have chosen to comply with all of the regulations, but then maybe lose out on a player as a consequence. So this is the element of balancing the integrity of competition there as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and a distinction that I hadn't really sort of fully understood until that point. So are we saying that a club could effectively sign a player but wouldn't be able to play them until they've been registered?
That's absolutely right. I mean, in general, clubs are not going to sign players unless they can then also get them registered,
of
because
course.
Then that's just an employee, and in those circumstances the player is stuck because he's not eligible to play, and the club's got the liability under the contract of employment without having the benefit of the player performing on the field of play as well. So what you'll find is that actually they make it subject to ensuring that the registration is processed. So we'll always seek to get to a point whereby contract is submitted, EFL will either accept or reject the registration in accordance with the regulations, and then the club deals with consequences in the event that it's a rejection. Our aim is not to reject. Our aim is to actually ensure that we work with clubs so that all applications that come in are going to get approved. We do a lot of training sessions with clubs, club secretaries in particular, and we meet with them prior to the start of each season, talk them through all the regulations, brief them on the various policies that applies, particularly around registration embargoes, so that we get the clubs to the point they know what they need to do in order to be able to get somebody successfully registered, because we don't want that situation arising where there is a contract but no registration.
How would a club exit an embargo?
By rectifying the relevant breach of the regulations that has led to the imposition. So if it hasn't filed a relevant document, then file it. If it hasn't paid a particular liability to another club or a player, for example, settle that liability. We'll be very happy to ensure that we lift the registration embargo promptly at that point.
I think at this point we should just stress clubs that are under an embargo are now disclosed publicly on the EFL's website. Why have you done that, Nick?
The league has tried to ensure that where it can, it is as transparent as possible with regards to the position at clubs. So that works both in the context of publication of ownership that we talked about earlier, but in this context, it's also showing to the widest stakeholder base, and particularly the fans, the position that a club is in at any particular point in time. Now, it's important probably just to stress here, we say the EFL has taken that step. I'm sure we'll come on to it, but the clubs have agreed to take that step by adopting that regulation.
Yeah.
And that is that the clubs have agreed collectively to accept a recommendation from the board that really these are of such interest to the wider public domain and the fans in particular, that where a club is under embargo, that should be notified more publicly. People can understand the position that's in. And it also helps the clubs as well. They can explain the challenges that they might be having in a particular area. We've just come off the back of the hardest 18 months that football has had for many, many years in terms of nobody expected that we would be playing a full season behind closed doors and the lost revenues that that has generated. And the clubs are have suffered and the owners have had to support their clubs throughout that whole process. And whilst there are registration embargoes that might arise as a result of the summer challenges of that, the clubs also are able to explain the circumstances behind that with this increased transparency, help fans understand some of the challenges that we've got as well.
I've loved you trailing ahead because we are going to discuss how EFL rules and regulations are formed and subsequently implemented. But can we just tidy up a couple of transfer related bits, if you don't mind? The process of a player being registered with a club and the formal actions of a transfer. Can you just explain those? Because we are in the middle of a transfer window at the moment. I think it'd be nice to give everybody a little insight.
We are. You're absolutely right. And a couple of seasons ago, working in conjunction with the Football Association and the Premier League, we developed a new system for the submission of papers online by clubs. The act of concluding the transfer negotiations between the clubs, documenting those in the transfer agreement, and the new club then negotiating and concluding the contract of employment with the new player all happens at their level. Where we get involved is that once that process is complete, the club will submit the transfer agreement, the application to register the player, the contract of employment, any associated documents, be that the bonus schedule that the player will sign up to in conjunction with the remainder of the squad, details of any payments made to intermediaries, and upload those to the EFL as one suite of documents into our online registration system. And that's across the Football Association, Premier League and EFL. So each of the bodies that needs to approve a transaction has access to it at exactly the same time. And a player will not be registered unless and until each of the bodies that is required to register it has done so. And that system also provides the clubs with a transparent dashboard where they can see the status of any application at any particular point in time. Queries that we might raise in respect of a transfer are flagged to the club using the system. They can then respond as appropriate, make any amendments that we might have required because a clause infringed a rule, for example, make those amendments, resubmit it via the system, and then we can improve it. And that system is core then to some of the key operations that clubs have going throughout the course of a season because all those players then remain in the database. It tracks all of their appearances, their contract details, which we utilise in order to monitor the financial regulations that we apply with clubs. And so it's all done that way. And that's how we now accept documents. And gone are the days where we used to be able to come into this office on the 1st of July and we would have massive of envelopes all full of all of the contracts, piles and piles of papers. We've got rid of that. We're a paperless organisation in that respect.
My goodness me, 1888 and this formation of the Football League and the first season and all the rest of it, but here we are moving with the times. I'll tell you what I want to ask you as well. Subject to EFL approval on transfer deadline day, what does that mean? Because I'm guessing your office is under quite a bit of strain, envelopes of contracts or electronic versions or not, on the actual day itself, you know, dealing with so many registrations, getting them ratified in a short space of time. But subject to EFL approval, that comes up on transfer deadline day.
Yeah, that is clubs effectively just making sure that whilst they've announced the particular transfer, they've always got to accept that it is subject to acceptance by the Football Association and or the EFL. And in the context of the Premier League clubs, the Premier League Registrations Department as well. So it's that process of the documents coming to us being required to check whether they have met the requirements of the rules. Do we require any amendments to be made? If not, then we will give that approval. But it just gives the clubs the opportunity that if there is a problem, for example, if they've missed a deadline or something like that, then at least they've front-ended that in terms of their communications with their supporters that, yes, we've done this, but it remains subject to EFL approval. Because that's the case with all transactions, to be honest with you, in respect of player registrations. They're always subject to our approval. But I think it's just clubs getting ahead of the communication cycle by saying, yeah, we've announced it, but it remains subject to EFL approval.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you, Nick, was about the deal sheet. We hear this a lot on transfer deadline day night. The deal sheet. A deal sheet's been handed in. What does that mean?
So far as the EFL is concerned, nothing. The deal sheet is a Premier League creation. And it allows Premier League clubs to put a deal sheet in prior to the, let's say, 11 o'clock at night deadline when we're all still in the office. And that gives them further time to then complete some of the additional documentation that's necessary to get a registration away. That does not exist under EFL regulations. It never has. Our clubs have always worked on the principle that for a deal to be registered inside a deadline for the EFL, the documentation has to be done and has to be submitted by that 11 p.m. deadline. And provided we get the registration form first on that 11 o'clock deadline, then we will be accepting that registration. We do not have a deal sheet.
Interesting. Okay, so we've talked owners and directors test. I got the title right, Nick. No need to nag me about that. We've talked about transfers. We've talked about registration embargoes. Can we talk about EFL rules and regulations, how they're formed and subsequently implemented? I mean, this has always been a point that I've tried throughout my broadcasting career to make. I always describe you guys as being like a sort of trade body association to enforce the rules that the club set. Have I been accurate all these years? Or with your legal head on, are you going to nag me on that one as well?
No, I'm not going to nag you. I think that is a significant part of what the EFL is.
I knew there'd be a but in there somewhere, Nicholas.
We are the enforcer of the rules that the clubs agree to adopt. But yeah, the clubs don't get to adopt the rules unless and until such time as somebody has sat down, consulted with them on the challenges that we face at any particular point in time, had those conversations, come up with some ideas of how we might regulate in the future going forwards. And that is what the clubs can expect the league, its executive and its board to do, to think about those areas in the collective interest of all clubs and then come forward with those proposals. So it's a cycle of communication, if I can put it that way. We talk to the clubs talk to us. Out of that, ideas are born. We're tasked with the idea of going away, writing something up and how it might look, and then taking that back to the clubs. And ultimately, they have to approve them. And the board and the executive working together will also take a step back and look at the challenges that we've faced and just bring forward recommendations anyway of particular areas where we think it should change. And we will then see if the clubs agree with us on that. And if they do, then we carry it forward. So all those ideas come from different places. And clubs will come to us from time to time and say, we think we need a rule that deals with this, please. And we'll take it away. We'll have a look at it. So it's absolutely a collaborative exercise. But we take the ideas from anywhere, really, and feed them into that process of consultation and discussion with the clubs before we get to the final vote. But once the regulations are in, then absolutely, it's the responsibility and the expectation of the clubs is that the EFL will then seek to apply those regulations on a consistent and fair basis.
Yeah, that must make you feel like you are in a position of strength in so much as if you can turn around, Nick, and say, well, they're the rules that you guys set. So what are you arguing about, to say it in simplistic rather than legal terms?
Position of strength, I don't necessarily agree with that one. I think as an organisation, the league is subject to similar duties that you might expect a public authority to be subject to. We've got to act reasonably. We must only take into account factors which are relevant. We must disregard factors that are irrelevant in all of our decision making. So we're not sitting above the clubs unilaterally choosing what to do without fear or favour and carte blanche as to how we go about things. We have to ensure that we comply with fair process, and that's an important safeguard, both in terms of protecting the league, but also fairness for the clubs and their owners as well.
Do you know what? I think this is one of the great misunderstandings, in my opinion, of supporters out there, or a lot of supporters out there. They just don't realise the involvement of their clubs in the actual process of, I don't know whether they think there's somebody sitting in a darkened room in Preston or London who just says yay or nay, this is what you've got to do, but I just don't think supporters fully understand the role that their own clubs play in setting those rules and regulations. Do you agree, Nick?
That may well be the case, and it's probably important then just to briefly explain what is required to get a regulation into the handbook that all clubs have to follow. Once a proposal is drafted, it has to be voted on by the clubs before it is binding as a regulation. And the vote that's required is that it is to change the regulations, a simple majority of all clubs present and voting. So 72 clubs will need 37 to vote in favour. And also we will need simple majority of the clubs in the Championship also voting in favour of that particular change. So we would need 13 out of the 24 Championship clubs to also vote in favour of a regulation change. And that's an important threshold. So they are absolutely at the heart of whether a regulation is ultimately adopted. Now, we've got some other areas of the handbook and the regulations where different majorities are required, particularly in the context of the financial fair play rules. So for the Championship, this used to be called financial fair play. Now it's called profitability and sustainability, and it's aligned with the Premier League. In the context of League One and League Two, this is our salary cost management protocols. Those rules are tailored to each specific division, and as a result, each specific division gets the opportunity to vote on those particular rules. For those rules to be adopted, we require a two-thirds majority of the relevant division. And so absolutely at the heart of the process of the adoption of the regulations, once we have been through the process of consultation, drafting of the proposals, feedback, and then putting them forward for the vote.
Is it a constant process? Are the rules and regulations constantly being reviewed? Are there points in the year where proposals for changes have to be sort of lodged? What happens?
It is a constant process, but we work hard not to change the rules that relate to the competition itself outside the summer window. So we must always try and ensure that competition-related rules are voted on and agreed by June each year ahead of the coming season. There are other areas of the regulations where it's not necessarily tied to the competition itself. If, for example, we wanted to introduce a new disqualifying condition under the terms of the owners and directors test, for example, that doesn't affect what's going on the field of play in terms of number of substitutes or something like that. So we could take those at another time. And there is a constant discussion around that. But the majority of rule changes we will always try and tie in to the summer meeting of clubs, which normally takes place the first week in June. And that's when we will see most of our proposals adopted. But the discussion that gets us to that point really does start in earnest back in probably about October, November.
So we've established our rules. They're voted on by clubs. When they aren't followed, when regulations are breached, what's the initial process, Nick?
So there'll have to be an assessment by the league's executive. So that will be myself. We've got a significant number of people working across the governance, the regulatory and the financial aspects of our regulations, and there will be an assessment as to whether there is a case to answer, at which point a club will be asked for its observations with regards to that. And it might be that we use powers of investigation that are granted tools under the regulations as well to require a club to provide documents or provide explanations of circumstances. And then we will assemble all of that factual information and what evidence that we have in those circumstances and determine whether we think that there is a prima facie case to answer. Does it look like there is a case to answer here? And if there is, then that would lead to a charge being issued by the EFL. So we would write to the club concerned and set out the regulation that we believe has been infringed and the base on which we believe that that infringement has occurred. And that forms the basis of the charge. At that point, the club has the opportunity then to consider a response to that charge, and it has 14 days in which to do that, unless it's a particularly urgent matter and we can have the 14 days shortened if something needs to be moved on quickly. So the club then always has the chance to decide whether it wishes to contest the charge or not, and then proceedings will follow as appropriate, dependent on whether the charge is accepted or not.
We keep hearing this phrase in extreme examples, independent disciplinary commission. What does it mean, and when might one get involved in the process of a regulation breach?
Any charge that is issued by the EFL will need to be referred to an independent disciplinary commission. And this is
everything. Nick, I want to be absolutely clear. Absolutely everything, even those. Is there such a thing as a minor one? Have you got a rap sheet with, you know, a £5 fine, a £10 fine, a £100 fine, like you would in the dressing room?
Yeah, just like the clubs have in the dressing room, there are some fixed financial penalties for the very technical offences. For example, the club didn't lodge its team sheet on time. But to be honest, we've put in place the systems, and the clubs are well tuned to that. That actually we. Not having to rely on that too much. Where it is a breach of regulations that's led to a charge letter being issued, that's when it will go to a disciplinary commission. And that can be quite simple matters. It can be quite complex matters. The range is quite broad in that respect. And those independent disciplinary commissions are an important part of ensuring that there is a separation of responsibility. The EFL and its member clubs have agreed through the process that we've talked about of what regulations are going to apply for a coming season. And then the EFL is expected to then apply those regulations fair and reasonably across all of the clubs on a consistent basis. And in doing that, it then needs somebody independent of all of those to then decide whether the regulation has actually been breached or not. And that's the commission's role.
So would I be confused about this? Because I suppose it's the extreme examples. I'm being very careful with my language now because your legal mind is around everything. But I guess I would hear the phrase independent disciplinary commission on the very high profile examples. But what you're basically saying is they're often going on quietly in the background all the time with everything that comes up as a result of a charge.
Our aim is to ensure that all decisions involving disciplinary commissions are actually published so that we can ensure that there's that greater degree of transparency around the decision-making process inside the league and where clubs are being sanctioned in accordance with the rules, or even where clubs have successfully established that regulations have not been breached and therefore defeated the charge. Now, whether a decision is published or not will very much depend on the individual case. Our aim and our objective is to ensure that at least across all clubs, all decisions are transparent with all clubs, and then those that go into the wider public domain are those which have a wider public interest. But yeah, so there can be some which are going on which the wider public don't see because they are pretty mundane and very low level, and therefore you tend to see in the public domain those that attract a wider public interest.
Wow. So I was quite accurate with that question, Nick.
It's a good question. They're all good questions.
Bless you. Why is there not a defined timescale in place for these independent disciplinary commissions? Why do some decisions seemingly take a greater amount of time than others?
I think that is a recognition of the principles of fairness, both in terms of the EFL presenting the case and also the club having the opportunity to respond to the case. There is a defined time frame at the outset. Charge, club 14 days to respond, and then the commission will control the timetable. And the importance of that is that the commission can understand the nature of the case. It has the details of the allegation, it has the nature of the club's response, and it can have an understanding of what evidence is going to be required to get to the truth of the matter. Because that's what's actually most important. And therefore, it will control the process of disclosure of documents, the exchange of witness statements, and then how long the hearing will actually be and when that can take place based on the availability of the commission itself, the legal advisers to the parties and the witnesses. So it's important that the chairs of the independent disciplinary commissions control that process, and they will set the directions for the process of the case based on the particular circumstances of that individual matter to ensure that the principles of fairness to all parties and natural justice apply.
And how do you, I don't need you to name names here, but how do you find the people on an independent disciplinary commission? Have you got a list? Are you looking for people of a certain background? I mean, how do you get on one of those and hold court, so to speak?
The EFL took a decision many years ago that it was important that the process of appointment of the independent chairs of disciplinary commissions was separate to the executive of the EFL. It would be a bit strange, Mark, wouldn't it, if I got to choose who the chairman of the disciplinary commission should be in my capacity as the governance and legal director of the league, when we're also acting as the prosecutor in respect of a breach of the regulations. We don't get to choose the judges. So many years ago, we took a decision that that should be dealt with externally. And we utilised the services of Sports Resolutions to provide nominations for the chairs of disciplinary commissions. Sports Resolutions have been established many years now and maintain panels of recognised experts in the area of sporting dispute resolution. And that's not just disciplinary matters, that's contractual disputes and arbitrations, anti-doping and all sorts. So there's a wide body of individuals out there who are qualified to act under the Sports Resolutions banner as chair. So we require Sports Resolutions to handle that appointment process for us. It gives us the access to a breadth of expertise that we wouldn't necessarily by adopting our own panel, and also ensures that the people who are eligible to sit on our commissions remain experienced and up to date in terms of their expertise, because there's a cycle of appointment and then reappointment through the sports resolution process. So by using them, we ensure that we've got that access.
Does a charge always lead to formal proceedings, Nick?
Not always, no. There are circumstances in which the club says, actually, do you know what? Yes, we accept that we've breached the regulation. And we've got a wide body of precedents of what an appropriate sanction might be. So a few years ago, the clubs agreed to adopt a regulation which allows us to enter into what's called an agreed decision, which means actually the sanction that's to be imposed for the breach that's been found can actually be agreed in advance. Now, to ensure that there's fairness across all clubs, we can't just go and agree anything with a club in those circumstances and just do a deal in that context. It's important that the agreed decision is then signed off by somebody who will be qualified to act as a chairman of one of our independent disciplinary commissions. And that gives that added level of oversight to ensure that the sanction that's being imposed is a fair and reasonable one in all the circumstances and balance out the interests of the competition as a whole.
Nick, do you think there's a perception that you're out to get clubs, whereas nothing could be further from the truth? All you want to do is maintain the rules and regulations.
Well, that's entirely the role of the EFL in this context. And as I said before, you know, there is an expectation on the EFL from the clubs themselves, who've been part of the process of adoption of these regulations, that we will then apply the regulations. So it's about assessing the facts to the circumstances and then assessing whether the regulations have been breached or not. And there are cases which have to be taken where it is suggested that there is a breach and a club may well successfully defend itself. That's fine. That's the principle of justice and fairness that we've tried to implement in the regulations. So it's not, there's no agenda against clubs or an object of trying to pursue clubs in that respect. It's a question of these regulations have been agreed, they have been adopted, and in those circumstances, breaches have to be seen through to a conclusion.
Nick, thanks for explaining all of this. I've learned loads this afternoon. I hope our listeners have as well. I've got to ask you, in those 20 years, has the football landscape changed from a legal perspective as much as it has on the surface of the game? It feels like a very different world, but is it inherently the same from your point of view, or are things very different?
I think that the wider perception of the game is that there are more legal disputes now than there were before. And I think that's just a recognition of the fact that the game has expanded both in terms of reach, but importantly, in terms of the amount of money that is at stake now. So, for example, the value of transfer fees now compared to 20, 30 years ago has been a massive increase. The amount of player wages now compared to 20, 30 years ago, significantly higher. And as the monetary value of transactions within the game increase, as the value of clubs increase, the number of disputes increases, and that therefore brings with it a higher level of risk. So yes is the short answer, but for that reason more than anything else, rather than a negative reason.
Great to talk to you, Nick.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of the Official EFL Podcast, looking at some of the inner workings of the EFL, its role, its functions, and its responsibilities. Thanks to governance and legal director Nick Craig. Watch out for other episodes when we'll continue our unique insight into the key functions of the organisation. Until then, I'm Mark Clement. Thanks for listening to this mini-series edition of
the Official EFL Podcast.